folks, welcome. My name is Jennifer Gray, and we're doing a kind of discussion dialogue today called Space, Time, and Architecture, or Reflections on Temporality, Technology, and the Experience of Place. So we're going to be looking at architecture at the scale of the individual building, but really thinking about larger spaces, like airports in general, or like how it affects the city in general, and that kind of thing. Before we get started, I do want to let people know that my particular talk is not in isolation. We're having a whole series of brown bag lunch lectures this spring that deal with issues related to temporality and time and contemporary art, and I'm doing architecture and just this kind of idea of time and how it impacts artwork. And this is culminating in a two-day contemporary art forum. Technology is impacting my sitting position, my sense of place.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that loud enough?
Can everybody hear?
Test. So this series of lectures that are looking at time, art, architecture, and how these intersect, it's culminating in a two-day forum called the Contemporary Art Forum that we're hosting here at MoMA on May 2nd and 3rd. And this forum is going to be looking at contemporary art in which the artists are really interested in long-term process-based art, where the emphasis is more on the making of it over time versus necessarily arriving at a finished, you know, product. It's not necessarily the end goal. It's about the long-term process of it. So it's a different way of kind of looking at and considering and making art, for that matter. So there's a whole schedule upstairs at the desk if you want to come to the other lectures or come to the art forum, so there's more information for you all up there. So if you enjoyed this today, it's just a little preview of all the various things that we're doing in relationship to art and time. So what I wanted to do to kind of start off our discussion and kind of get us talking right away is I sent out a little questionnaire, this quiz that I put around. There's no right and wrong answer, so you don't have to be stressed out about it, but I wanted to kind of go through a little bit and get a sense of how people answered the questions, because I tried to write them in such a way as to put us mentally into a place where we're starting to think about how space and time, and space-time as a continuous phenomenon, interact with our experience of place and actually inform our sense of place. So how did you get to MoMA today? This was my first question. So how many of you walked here? I'm lucky enough to walk here. How many of you took the subway? Most of us took the subway because we live in New York, right? How many of you drove in a car or maybe took a taxi even? Nobody. That's pretty good. That says a lot about New York as like a pedestrian mass transit type of city. If we were living in Atlanta, Georgia, how many of us do you think would take a car? Probably like almost all of us. Yeah. So it depends on where you live, right? Did anyone fly here specifically for me?
Well, we flew a couple of days ago.
Okay, but I'm just a coincidence. Okay. That's fair. So two people actually flew to New York, and they're taking advantage of things like MoMA while they're here, right? Oh, you guys flew too. So four people flew. That's a lot for five people. That's a lot for one room. Six. All right, so we're going to talk about flying and sort of the way that it transforms. Kind of transition in terms of how you experience things. You're transferred from like an everyday life to like the life of a traveler or a tourist. I mean, it's an existential change in your state of being when you fly. So welcome, all of you. I guess we can ask, if I had an iPad or something hooked up on Skype, we could ask how many people are going to view this remotely. We do record them, as you're seeing, which is why my setup with the microphone here, and we've got this recorder, so that we can post them on our website, and people do engage in these discussions at later dates. They do it remotely. I don't know that we stream live in this, but some things we do stream live. So in some cases, you don't even have to come at all, and you can experience the place, right? So it doesn't, or the lecture, so it doesn't require a change in space and time. It happens instantaneously, right? Okay, so given the ways that you got here, what did you see most of along the way? A, other people, hot dog vendors, cafes, shop windows, this kind of stuff. How many of us saw stuff like that? I see a lot of construction sites on my walk here. And how many of you are the people that walked here? From where a hotel or wherever you're staying. Most of us, the pedestrians, right? If you had taken a car here, none of us did, but if you had taken a car here, let's say from a suburb, what do you think you would have seen most of?
Cars.
Yeah, other cars, signs, billboards, advertisements. The mode of travel, how you get there and how fast you get there, does determine the built environment to some degree around you. So billboards and signs and whatnot along the side of a highway or something like this, they are large scale, they are separated from the buildings normally, and that's intended to allow you to read them moving at high speeds rapidly, very quickly, right? You can't see the details of a cafe or a shop window when you're driving in a car necessarily. So it does alter that space-time relationship of driving in the car versus walking does change the built environment. How many of you just really stared at your cell phone or your tablet or your computer if you're on the subway, like an iPad or something? One person. If they only had wireless connection in the subway, it would probably be a much higher number, right? So sometimes you really don't notice the space around you because you're actually in an other space, the space of technology, right, the cell phone. Which unit of measurement below best describes your journey, 30 minutes or less? Again, we're very lucky people in New York to only have to almost just walk, not too long of a commute. How about an hour for some of you? It seems like it's split half and half, 30 minutes to an hour. How many 15 miles? How many put 15 miles? Nobody put 15 miles. How many put 20 to 60 blocks? How many put any length of distance whatsoever?
20 miles.
You put 20 miles, okay. How instantaneously, how would that be accessed? That would be like remotely, right? That you wouldn't have to use any time whatsoever. You're just like instantly plugged in. What I wanted to do with that question is to make you kind of think about the fact that because of modern technologies, like first the train, and then the car, and now the airplane, we measure distance in terms of time today rather than in terms of distance. So when you think about how long is it till from New York to Tokyo, I think 13-hour flight. Actually, I have no idea how many miles it is, right? I don't actually think about the distance, right? It's the length of time it takes you to get there. So the fact that you understand space in terms of time versus spatially is due to these modern technologies. That's another thing to kind of keep in mind that we kind of take for granted today, but we tend to measure space and time. What was the primary reason for your last airplane flight vacation? Ooh, lucky people, a lot of vacations. Visiting family. Okay. Well, some people say that's the same thing almost, right? You might wrap it kind of together, right? Work. Okay, I know I have one coming up too. Simply to reach frequent flyer status milestone. People do this. If they're close to a status milestone, they will just fly to DC back and forth in one day a couple of times, reach it so they can get gold or whatever, because the benefits that you accrue being of that status are worth the day and the cost of the flights. A lot of people do this, believe it or not. So that's another reason to fly, right? We're going to talk about airports and whatever else, but how they operate is this new kind of social condenser that do indicate levels of status and whatever else and the links that people go to achieve that. What did you do in the airport? Circle all that apply. Security check. We all go through the security check. Hung out at a restaurant or bar. Watch TV. I usually end up watching TV at the restaurant or bar than I'm at. Visited a members-only lounge. Less people, right? That's part of that status thing that starts happening. Went shopping. Invariably, even if it's just for a coat. But how many of you actually bought things, like perfume or, like clothing, that kind of thing, right? Duty-free shopping. Reunited with a loved one. Only a few people. That says a lot about the change in how we view air travel now. It's not so much about visiting far-flung loved ones and the idea of reuniting with them in the terminal has become almost obsolete given how much people travel for work, but also because of security issues. The day where you could like drop your loved one off and kiss them as they walked onto the plane are over, right? So that idea of how we use the airport has changed, and airport design has changed as well. I can't remember the last time someone picked me up at an airport and like hugged me in the airport. I mean, best case scenario is like a kiss and ride where you like call them and they swing by and pick you up on the highway that now covers the airport, right? Took a train at the airport. I did on my last flight. I was in Atlanta. They have a train in the airport, right? Conversed with a stranger. Many people do. Caught up on personal phone calls and emails. Everyone, almost. Slept. A lot of people slept. Where did you sleep? Can I ask you? I didn't put that on here, bud.
On the seats.
Like, on the seats. How many actually were lucky enough to get a hotel? A hotel. Okay, one. Two people. Okay. Increasingly, people sleep in the airport. There's actually a website you can visit that tells you the best airports for sleeping and, like, where to go in them. Like, on the seats and stuff, not for hotels. Yeah. Increasingly, people are using the airport for overnight stays. Worked. Picked up a sexual partner.
What's that mean?
People do this there. They use the parking garages. We'll talk more about that. Had some kind of emotional breakdown. Canceled flight, lost bag, delay, overcrowded board. Seat reclining into you, baby screaming, like whatever, right? So my point and most of us probably circled a lot of those, actually. And my point for bringing that up is that airports are increasingly starting to operate like cities, in fact, and the design of them actually mimics urban spaces. So we're going to talk about whether or not the contemporary airport is actually a city and what differentiates it from a real city, that we might actually walk around in like a New York City, or maybe they're not the same. Maybe an airport is the city of the future. Increasingly, people do things too, like how many of you have gone to a conference in Dallas-Fort Worth, just for the sake of not there necessarily, but a conference where you never left the airport area. You flew there, went to a nearby hotel that had conference facilities, stayed there, and then went back on a flight. That happens too, right? So you go to places with never having gone to them, actually. You're just existing in this like meta-environment of the travel corridors, right, and all the infrastructure that goes along with that. So these are just the kinds of things we're going to be talking about today, but you probably didn't even really realize how much these different technologies and modes of travel affect the way you experience place, right? So what I want to do to get us started, I'm going to kind of run through a little history of different types of technologies in the earlier 20th century and how they began changing space, and hopefully we'll spend most of our time talking about the airports and how this has changed things. Air travel is certainly like the wave of the future. Not the future, it's the wave of the present, but even more so, we're just doing it more and more. And it's less articulated in the field. So there's been a lot of research looking how trains impacted our experience of the cities, but it's newer, the idea of how air travel is infecting societies and cities. I'm hoping we can have a dialogue about it and we can start kind of fleshing out for ourselves what's at stake here. So I'm gonna start with, let me click to something. I'm gonna start with the first technologies, like air travel, end this for a second. So I want to play for you a symphony, if you can call it that. It's by an Italian futurist composer, and it's called Awakening of a City. And I want you to listen to this musical score and then tell me what you think it's the narrative is about, what the music is about, what the sounds are about. You can actually listen to this upstairs in the Inventing Abstraction show. Was that?
Construction.
Traffic.
Yeah. Train.
Railroad, maybe.
Train.
A railroad also?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably going over the tracks, right? Some of them I can't quite identify even. Some of them sound like a moped to me for some reason. I don't know if that... probably not at this time.
Train going through a tunnel.
Yeah, going through a tunnel. A train going through a tunnel, maybe.
Yeah, because you've got lots of echo.
Yeah, it echoes in the tunnel.
Yeah.
Pipes? That's a good guess. Yeah, that sounds more like a motorcycle, right? Or maybe a private automobile. We've talked about trains, but the car, interesting. I mean, there's cars already. This is 1915, I believe, or somewhere around there. There are private automobiles at this time. They're not, obviously, they're not totally mass yet, but they're getting there. The private automobile affords you the luxury of having control over your own locomotion. So it's different than a train where you're a passive rider on the train and you don't determine where the train goes. You have to pick from pre-selected routes for you. The car affords more freedom, so we'll talk about that, but it's a different mode of transportation. So point being, I'll stop this for now. Again, if you're interested, go upstairs and look at this. It's up in the, or hear it, I should say. It's up in the Inventing Abstraction show. The point being is that this particular artist, Luigi Russolo, he understood modern music, or music in general, to be a little bit narrow in terms of apprehending the oral environment around us or the auditory environment around us. It's based on notes. It's based on tones. It's based on a certain set of sounds that we hear, not the other sounds. So we tend to distinguish between musical sounds and just noise sounds that are kind of everyday life. And he believed that in the modern era, you know, most of what we experience from a day-to-day basis is more like the sounds of the city, like cars, mopeds, the train, the clanging of the tram, just like the noise of the crowd, like bustling around and this kind of thing. And he thought that modern music should expand to incorporate these new modern sounds, and modern ways of experiencing the city. And this is partly conditioned by new technologies, which is why I wanted to kind of start with this. Not only is it a segue to the city, but technology factors in here. The invention of the phonograph in 1877 really opened up people's perceptions about what constituted music, because a phonograph, it records all sound as just vibrations and frequencies. So music, which we usually ascribe to some kind of spiritual, you know, artistic kind of domain, it's just recorded as vibrations and frequencies the same way that any noise is recorded. So the phonograph doesn't discriminate between music versus the moped outside, right? If you've ever done recordings, I've done a few of these, if the door accidentally slams in the background, you have to stop and like redo it, right? Because it picks up anything. So the machine there, the technology of the phonograph, it just mechanically records any of it. And so this kind of caused people to think about sounds in new ways that were more abstracted and were more expanded, basically, than they had been before. And we're going to be talking about new modes of perceiving the city as also being more abstract and more expanded than people had seen it before. So my point is that what we're talking about with architecture, it's concurrent with a broad cultural shift in understanding just modes of perception were changing in the early 20th century. So it's not confined just to architecture. You can see it in music. You can see it in painting. I'll show you some cubist works here. It's a broad just realignment of how people perceive the everything around them, basically, even in music. So let me clip back to my PowerPoint. Oh, whoops, I must have clicked it, sorry. Okay, let me get this out of here. Okay. All right, so I brought it. I wanted to start with a painting here. You can also see this in MoMA. It's up on the fifth floor. 1911 is the date. It's called The Farewells by another Italian futurist painter. So we looked at a futurist composer. This is a futurist painter. States of Mind, Umberto Boccioni. Before I blab on about it, what it is, looking at this image, can you all discern any elements of the city or of modern living or of technology in the painting?
It looks, steam train at the top.
Yeah, steam train at the top. Alan, what were you going to say? Also a train. What else? I see some half-raised. Yeah, on the upper left, there's some kind of power, like electrical tower of some kind, right? Okay. So we've got these infrastructures of technology indicated. Yeah, river, this kind of flowing diagonal type of like curvilinear line that you see. They could be rivers.
Or highways.
Or highways. We're in 1911, so we might not be at highway stage yet. That's more middle of the 20th century. We have an electric light, the red light. This is the train switches and signals and that kind of thing. Electricity, even as a technology, also totally transforms your relationship to space and time, because now you can be up all night long. The idea of the 24-hour city or like working into the evenings, you don't have that until you have electricity. So that alone just changes the workday, it changes office environments, it changes the pace of life is sped up because now the possibilities of what you can do on any given day are extended, right, because you have an extended day. So the light alone is a big change.
Are those factories up in the upper right-hand corner?
Yeah, the question is, are those factories up in the upper right-hand corner? They could be. They certainly look like some kind of infrastructure. My light's not working. Get up. This, is that what you're talking about, up in the upper right-hand corner? It definitely could be factories. It almost appears to look like concrete block type construction for my architecture people here. It's probably the train, I think, is what it might be. So to point out, sorry, I'm going to have to get up. To point out where we are, the train, just to make sure we're all on the same page, there's two trains. There's a smokestack here with the billowing. There's another one here coming into a train station. If you look carefully, you might see the cars, the roof of the cars is here, and there's windows. There's another here. That's probably more cars. There's actually people, if you look closely, you can see like their abstracted ghost-like faces in the windows there. This is the switch signal again of the train, the number of the train perhaps, right? They're rendered in a completely fragmented kind of way. It's borrowing from cubism. So again, you can go upstairs and look at this, but it's a totally shattered, fragmented, simultaneous way of viewing this space. You're not seeing it in a logical space-time. So you can't glue the pieces back together and it makes sense as a landscape. It's just like a fragmented, non-narrative, discontinuous space. We've got the tower up here, and what some people think of as mountains is actually the train station. Do you see these arcs right here? That's the roof of the train station. So you might actually see the windows. Do you see the kind of mullions between the window panes here, that gridded thing? That's the lunette window that's typical of train stations at the time. So like Grand Central, you know, those big rounded windows up at the top, lunette windows are very common in train stations for the first half of the 20th century because they allow a lot of light into a big space. The more natural light you get in there, the less electricity you have to put in. And before electricity, that's a big deal, right? So this is probably a train station. So we basically have a modern city here, right, that's being transformed by these technologies. The train, and I know we kind of take the train for granted today or almost think of it as kind of a slower, maybe anachronistic way to get around unless you're just commuting, but the train transformed people's relationship to space and time. Let me click forward to another image. I'll come back to that. Oh, you know what? I didn't put it in here. Sorry. The train transformed people's relationship to space and time. And let me give you an example. If you, the day that you could take a train from New York City to San Francisco, this is sometime in the 1860s. I can't remember when the Transcontinental Railroad was totally completed. But the day that you can take a train from New York to San Francisco, this is the first step towards radically transforming people's relationship to space and time and their place in the world. Because now a trip that was one time, how long would that have taken you before the train? How would you have gotten there?
40 days.
On the train or before the train?
Oh, before the train.
40 days before the train to get from New York to San Francisco?
Probably months.
Months. Years, probably, actually. How would you have gotten there before the train? Like a wagon or horse or something, right? So it's a very long, labor-intensive, you probably have to stop over in the winter somewhere and just like camp out and hang out like in a town or something for, you know, shelter and whatnot. So really that was a very risky, long trip. I mean, for most people, a trip like that would have been the trip of a lifetime, if you even made it, right? I mean, it was not uncommon that some horrible accident would happen along the way, or you would just give up, and you stop in Kansas, right, or something like this. So, you know, having a train suddenly meant that you could get from New York to San Francisco in, let's say, a week or something like this. It also meant that more people could do the trip, because the labor of doing it was kind of taken out of the process. So space and time already right there is immediately sped up. And once you start getting other technologies like that telegraph tower that we have in there, when you can send a message over space and time instantaneously via the telegraph, then with the phone, then with TV, then with the cell phone, right? This also completely contracts space and time. So these technologies, they do alter people's understanding of the environment around them. Space gets a lot smaller, right? Now we think of a globalized world. You can traverse the globe in an airplane in a day or something like this. But it does completely alter your conception of where you are in space. So the early moderns are very much grappling with this. The train also introduced a very fragmented sense of space. And to give you another example, those of us who took the subway here, right? When you take a subway, imagine if you left MoMA, you're leaving sort of midtown corporate high-rise, you know, kind of type of architecture. A certain kind of culture exists in this area too, right? Maybe a lot of people in suits going to work if you're here during the week, different kinds of restaurants. Let's say you got on the E train across from MoMA from here. Let's say you went down to Soho, got off at, you know, Spring Street or something like that. You come out into a totally different neighborhood. It's lower rise buildings, they're older, it's more bohemian, different kinds of people are down there. Did you see the space in between? No, you reread advertisements for Manhattan mini storage or whatever it was that's on your train, but you don't experience the space changing over that time, right? You're in this kind of hermetically sealed environment of the subway. And so the subway alone is just one example. You can, I think, see how these technologies fragment our sense of space and time, that we experience the city as a series of fragmented, non-narrative, discontinuous series of experiences. We rarely, unless you were to walk from here down to so, which sometimes we do, right? You can see things changing slowly over time. With these new modes of transportation, not only does it speed it up, but it fragments it. So we rarely see things changing over time. If you fly to a new location, like New York to Tokyo, I used that example before, you don't see all the locales in between. You exist in this metaspace of the airplane for 13 hours watching your movie so that you're not anywhere, right? And then you land in a totally different culture. So that's a fragmented way of experiencing the world around us, not narrative. Oh, I thought you had kind of a question. And I just wanted to show you a couple of images. This is picked up in film very early on. I think most of us probably have seen images of Metropolis by Fritz Lang. This is 1927. It's a science fiction kind of film, essentially. But he takes New York as his kind of inspiration to create the stage sets for this film. And you can see that the city is starting to be also like a fragmented, discontinuous, simultaneous set of experiences. So on the street level, you have cars kind of going and pedestrians and whatnot, but there's also sky bridges where people are traversing space at a distance so they're removed from the other folks down below. And then above that, we have an airplane circling. So you can see the city vertically, but also you experience it fragmentedly, and there's different publics and technologies operating in all those spaces. So it's the fragmented, discontinuous, almost cinematic way of seeing the city that we're describing. And many historians have linked film to the experience of the modern city because film is also fragmented and splintered. Literally, it was spliced, like literally fragmented and splintered by cutting the film and putting it back together. Now we digitally edit, right? But you literally splice the film. When you're watching a film, you just cut to the next scene. You don't necessarily watch, like if the woman is going to her lover's house because she's found out that he's having an affair with somebody else, you don't necessarily watch her tedious drive for 45 minutes as she gets there. She's just like angry from the phone call, and the next minute she's at the lover's house, right? So the film itself is like a fragmented mode of perception, and that just speaks to the broad modes of perception that were informing modern life in the early 20th century. And there's just, I just don't want to spend too much time on this because I want to do the airports, but just so you know, architects did pick up quite a bit on this. This is a famous project by Le Corbusier. It's a contemporary city for 3 million people from 1922, not built, as you can imagine. But he envisions the entire city as this kind of simultaneous, multi-plane, fragmented series of technologies and transportations. So the lower level, you can see highways and whatnot. There's trains submerged beneath that. A transportation hub is the heart of his city. Not a public plaza, not a civic building, not a square. It's transportation, right? Layered transportation at that. The kind of target that you see in the center is the landing strip. So this is where the airplanes would land, which I think in a post 9/11 era, the idea of having a landing strip amidst the skyscrapers that are surrounding it is just, you know, not even an option at this point. But that just speaks to the optimism that people had about these new technologies of understanding this world in this kind of fragmented and constantly moving cinematic kind of way. Here's a proposal for Manhattan, again, not built, but these were just so you know, it's not just these idealistic utopian architects thinking about space this way. It really becomes kind of common parlance by the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. I'm not really sure how, if you're a pedestrian underneath that highway, what is your experience of that space? Yeah, you can't see anything, you can't breathe. I mean, it's loud, right? I mean, there's actually these very optimistic images of people like sipping a cappuccino right underneath a highway that's in a building. I mean, you know, so in reality, these don't actually work, but it speaks to the optimism that we could, in fact, have like a unified experience out of these fragmented, faceted jars. And I just wanted to point out, we're not going to talk too much about it because we're going to be dealing with urban space, but I just wanted to point out that concepts of nature and the wilderness are also concurrent with concepts of technology. They go hand in hand. I think this is such a stunning image. This is actually an early kind of advertisement for Yellowstone. 1908, I think, is the date on this. It's amazing for the way that it compresses various historical epochs and modes of transportation and modes of experience into one image. So on the left-hand side, who do we have at Yellowstone?
Tourists.
A woman, nicely dressed, right? Where are they staying?
Hotel.
Old Faithful Inn. It's already built by this point. There's the geyser, right? Old Faithful. So they're staying in a hotel. They're tourists. Women can go there. This is the quote-unquote wilderness, right? How do they? And then on the right-hand side, who do we have there? A Native American, a fur trapper. These are the pioneers that would have first occupied the space, right? Never mind that they're coexisting peacefully, which might never have happened, but they somehow are coexisting historically at the same time as the travelers that have gotten there. How? By the Northern Pacific Railroad. This isn't a brochure, an advertisement for the Northern Pacific Railroad. So you don't even have concepts of wilderness until you can get there, right? But aside from that, especially touring wilderness, the idea of touring landscape or landscape being a leisure space, you don't have the idea of nature being a touristic or a leisure space until society has evolved to the point where the people in cities are no longer dependent directly on nature for their subsistence. So a worker doesn't view nature as a leisure space. I mean, I'm sorry, a farmer doesn't view nature as a leisure space. He views it as a workspace, right? If you're a trapper trying to survive in the Rockies over the winter, you don't view nature as a leisure space. You view it as like this, like, you know, force that you have to overcome. So the idea of seeing nature and having wilderness as this leisure activity, this is completely dependent upon these technologies. So we're going to be looking at cities, but I just wanted to point out that even our concepts of like the quote-unquote natural world are determined by these technologies. And here's just a way that we experience these spaces. This is a woman Kodaking as a verb at the time, but taking pictures of the landscape. We mediate our understanding of the built environment with technology. So, and we do it even more now today. Like, how many of you are on social media? I'm actually not anachronistically enough. How many of you post pictures constantly that you take on your cell phone onto your social media? Lots of people do, right? Stick it on there. There's nothing wrong with it. But we often experience the world around us through these digitally mediated technologies, which also, again, changes our understanding of those spaces. Most of my friends who are on Facebook, you don't post any old picture on Facebook necessarily. You try and get the best one, or you get one that expresses something about the identity of yourself that you're trying to craft, right? So my sister, for example, really curates her Facebook page. So she's, you know, got these beautiful pictures, but they're all very artfully chosen and framed to produce like a brand of herself that she's trying to put out there in the space of social media. So when she sees the built environment, she might not be looking so much at the architecture or the cafe. She's looking at how she can frame it in a photograph that dovetails with her, you know, idea of herself that she wants to transmit to a public. So it's another way of sort of seeing the space around you, right? Determined by technology. So that's already starting in the late 19th century. Women actually were some of the largest numbers of people that did photographs because it was a way for them to engage nature or the environment without getting too physical, because they can be passive kind of observers because they're taking a picture and fixing it in time. They're not in it like camping and that kind of thing. Oh, already by 1900, there's a whole series of, there's a tour that you go on at Yellowstone. It's not just today. And it's determined by the major sites, which are pre-selected by the tourist companies that build the roads in Yellowstone, and it's geared towards where you can get the best pictures. So we understand Yellowstone as a series of like picture-taking opportunities, right? I won't go into that for time. Okay, middle of the 20th century. What supersedes the railroad? Highways and cars. Let's talk about pedestrian life. In the early 20th century, trains were... they were used for commuting in some cities, like New York or Boston. You'd have small commuter rails going out to the first suburbs. But for the most part, trains might entail a longer trip the way we might associate with like an airplane or something like that today. So people still walked a lot, and many of us walk here. The city's often a pedestrian-type experience. By the time you have automobiles, what kind of built environment are you often living in if you're driving everywhere? Yeah, more often in a suburb, right? What kinds of buildings? This is the image I'm... showing you here. This is taken from a seminal, often considered one of the first postmodern texts, written by Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, called Learning from Las Vegas. And they were interested in understanding these kind of new built environments, like suburbs and highways and freeways and this kind of thing, as an entirely new architectural building type. And what they proposed is that, I can ask you guys, when you drive everywhere, what do you see in the built environment? I mean, I kind of included it in the questionnaire here, but... you see strip malls along the side of the road. I'm sorry? Advertisements. Yeah, advertisements, billboards, marketing is what you said. Absolutely, billboards, so you're marketed to. What else?
Directions
on how to get to where you're going, especially on highways. The signage is actually highly regulated, even down to like the font that is used on the signs to determine easy readability at very high speeds across vast distances. So you're often reading things that are maybe a quarter mile away, and you're going 70 miles an hour, so you need to be able to read them across vast distances at high speeds rapidly. So it dictates a certain kind of built environment. Now, I think we can look at this image of Las Vegas that Venturi gives us almost as a little bit nostalgic, right? Because what do these signs look like? This is early Las Vegas. It's not Las Vegas today.
Advertisements.
They're advertisements, and they're also... casino. There are four hotels and casinos and this kind of thing. But the signs actually have a lot of detail in terms of like the design of them. So they look kind of quirky and unique. Each one says something about the place that it's representing. Signs today are often more generic, right? Just to give you a point here on the... this is also another part of Las Vegas, probably the part that you don't want to go to. It's just the coffee shops and whatever else. But the signs literally occupy, it dominates your field of vision. So the mode of perception from the car, the way it determines the built environment, is you actually see the environment as a series of signs, flat two-dimensional signs that signify something behind it. But the architecture is kind of you know, secondary or not relevant at all. The Venturis call this the decorated shed effect. So the diagram on the upper right here just kind of shows you what they mean. In order to apprehend the signs across vast distances moving at high speeds rapidly, they have to be detached from the building. Because you just can't, can you see like the architectural ornament around a window when you're going 60 miles an hour? Like the individual details of place are gone, right? So you miss that. So the sign has to kind of stand in for that. So you recognize places simply by their signifiers. They don't necessarily have to have an architecture. So the architecture increasingly becomes just a banal blank box that we call a decorated shed on which a sign is attached. So you can see here they just have this blank box and like each is like attached onto it. But think like a Walmart or a Target or anything. I mean, just these are ubiquitous in suburban type environments or in sprawl type environments. So architecture is almost irrelevant in these cases, like the design of the spaces, other than conveniences and efficiency. Getting maximum number of people in, getting them out, air conditioned. There's often very few windows in them. They really are just sheds, and they're pumped full of air conditioning and heating. The more windows you have, the more complicated you have to get with organizing the shelves and whatever else. So having just a blank box is actually the most versatile, efficient space. But as a person experiencing that space, the experience is often very kind of vitiated and just sort of shallow in a way that you're not really experiencing much of anything, right? It's just these signs. So if you've been to like big box stores and these kinds of things, it can all start feeling kind of the same and just very banal and kind of boring. And part of it's because that form of communication is prioritized over actual architecture. Oh, and here's just an example. This is from our collection. We don't have it hanging right now, but Toys R Us. This would be a typical type of scene that you would see driving, you know, maybe in a suburb of New Jersey or something like this, that you just have these big box stores. They're only known by their sign. Otherwise, you have no idea what's going on inside of them. So the architecture itself does not really serve as a communicator anymore. So let's do airports. Does anyone recognize this airport? Yeah, this is a JFK. At this time, it's called Idlewild. JFK Airport. It's the old TWA terminal, designed by Aero Sarin in the mid-1950s. He finishes it in 1962. Just show you. I just brought in a couple of these, like just totally fetishistic shots because they're so beautiful. I couldn't pick just one, so I picked a couple of them. Here it is, back in the heyday when it was still TWA. Here's the interior. Here's the lounge. I wish they had such elegant lounges now. They used to have lounges like this in the early airplanes. Like you could stand and walk around and that kind of stuff. They're all designed by designers, actually. Now you're like forced to strap down the seat. These are these tubes that actually connected the TWA terminal to the airplanes. If you look at here, can you see these tubes here? The way you got to the airplanes when this was built in the late 1950s is this was the main terminal kind of gateway where you experienced all those space age kinds of shapes. To get to the planes, you actually walked out to the planes from these tubes, kind of like the jetways that we now see, but they were actually integral to the building. They were like part of the design. They weren't just these mobile units that like attached up. They were part of the architecture, and you actually went out to the planes from that. So that tube that I showed you is the interior of one of those spaces. What place do you think that Saarinen is trying to evoke in this design?
The plane itself.
The plane itself, right? You could definitely argue that these are like the wings of the plane, that it references something about flight. I had another interesting...
Cathedral.
Yeah, church, someone said. Why do you say cathedral? It's a vast space. I'm sorry? It is kind of an awe-inspiring space. I mean, when you go into here, it is this open, kind of like airy space, kind of awe-inspiring because it is so designed, right? I mean, everything about it is geared towards giving you a physical and emotional experience. So you could almost argue that it's kind of like a sacred type of experience. You're definitely moved by this architecture. It's not just like a box, right? There's something expressive about it. Any other thoughts? I always think almost like space age.
Everything flows. So it looks as though you're in your travel, yeah?
Right,
based
yeah.
on travel, because there's every curve is curved, so there's no sort of final point.
Right. The comment is that all of the forms are curved and kind of flow together, and so in that sense, it almost evokes like air travel itself or aeronautics itself, right? That it's like the aerodynamics of actual flight are somehow evoked in the expressivity of design. And that's his intention. He does want it to evoke all these ideas. So these early airports were actually intended to give you this kind of special experience, I would argue. Travel, as we noticed when we did our little kind of check-in here, more and more often people travel for work or these kinds of more mundane means. But, you know, travel, commercial air travel became kind of mass in the 1960s. And at that time, travel, though, was still kind of this, like, special experience. You dressed up to go travel. I mean, if you're going to sit in a lounge, like, people wearing suits, right, to get on the plane here. You are transformed from an everyday person just doing your everyday things. You're existentially transformed into, like, a tourist or a travel. It's like a special state of mind and a special state of being. And the airport was there to kind of assist you in that transformation and to be this kind of special place to exist in. And the designs helped to do that. And that has changed, I think, considerably. Here's just an aerial shot of JFK. Here's the TWA terminal, now defunct. You can see the tubes there. How do you get around JFK? By bus. And why do you have to take a bus around JFK? How are the terminals organized? Domestic and foreign, but also... Yeah, around a circle. By company. Each airline has their own terminal that they're responsible for maintaining. So that TWA terminal is JetBlue now. If you've flown JetBlue out of there, they've built a new terminal. That's another issue. How do you retrofit these like old airports? It's an ongoing mess. But JetBlue's built a new terminal adjacent to the TWA terminal. The TWA one is landmarked, so no one wants to tear it down. But it's too small and too particular of a design to accommodate contemporary air travel. And so it's just kind of like laying... landmarked but defunct at the moment, and we're not really sure what, you know, how they're going to use it, basically, or we'll just operate as kind of a monument to a bygone era. We're not really sure yet, but you basically travel around by bus and now by the air train to go to the different terminals, so they're not linked together, or you take a car. So the design of the airport as a whole mimics the design of contemporary cities, that you go by car or you go by a train, you traverse some kind of highway, almost like a suburb, and you can pop off the highway at different stops, which are the terminals. Now, if you are transferring between airlines, this is the bane of your existence because there is no like direct passageway, right? So very quickly, by the late 1970s and 80s, airports began changing their design. I tried to pull like artistic shots, so a bunch of these are from Gary Winogrand because he does a whole airport series, mostly Los Angeles, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and it speaks to the kind of changes in airport design. First of all, planes get bigger. Wide-bodied large jets are introduced by the late 1970s, and this facilitates a massive reorganization of airport spaces. Saarinen's terminal was literally, in 1962 it was finished, within like a decade, the larger planes cannot fit up to those tubes. That's like the biggest thing. It became like outmoded and obsolete almost immediately because those tubes were too particular. So the really big jets, though, and now it's even bigger, the Dreamliner and all this kind of thing, these jets did actually transform the design of the airports and how we experience them. So here's one of the big jumbo jets that I'm showing you here. What is the one incongruous element in this picture? There's a man on a bicycle riding across the tarmac. I mean, this to me, this is 1978, which isn't that long ago, but this would never happen today. I mean, there would be like a SWAT team surrounding you if you went out onto the tarmac, right? So we understand the airport today to be a much more like militarized kind of space than we, and we feel that when we're there, and I'll show you some designs and how they accommodate that. But at this time, the airport is still porous enough, right, and public enough and kind of open enough to real human activities that you can find something like this, right? There's still like a guy on a bike riding across the tarmac. You used to get onto planes by going onto the tarmac, which very occasionally you'll still do at LaGuardia if you're taking one of those commuter flights, but they take you on a special bus, even if it is like one block to get to the plane. You have to wait for this bus. They take you right there because the fear that you might like throw yourself into a jet engine or something is just, you know, it's liability, right? But we've created this kind of like militarized, like securitized kind of space, which makes people nervous, actually, oftentimes. So even though this is only like 30 plus years ago, it seems like there's still something sentimental, nostalgic, and past about it, right? It's still open enough. Here's from the same series. How does this architecture compare to Saarinen's?
So sterile.
Yeah, it's so sterile and kind of modular, just like the drop ceilings with the lights there.
Confining.
Especially older airports that have been retrofit, like JFK has just, they've tried to like update it piecemeal, and you're just in this like labyrinth of like mishmash spaces that some of which are renovated and some of which aren't. It's very like, yeah, confining and kind of claustrophobic and hard to find your way around.
The lack of fluidity, like the three things, the only signage you see are the three things you can't do.
That's a good point. That's a good point. The only signs you see are things that you can't do, right? So it speaks to this, again, the kind of highly controlled, structured, almost militarized experience that you have in the space. Don't do
like
this. Do this.
Uniforms look like, he looks like a cop. The pilot looks like a cop.
Yeah.
The original design of like a Pan Am, like the stewardess would look like a cocktail waitress.
Right, right.
It's a very kind of free-flowing design in a uniform.
Yeah, that's a good point. The officers look like police officers, the flight attendant, the flight officers or the pilots or whatever, just so we're all, we can all hear. They kind of look like military personnel themselves, almost like they're policemen. And the flight attendants, they used to be called stewardesses, you know, back in the 60s, they dressed up more like cocktail waitresses, actually. So the emphasis was on having fun and having a leisure experience, the design of it, even to the uniforms, but certainly the scale of the building contributed to that. Now, oftentimes, and maybe this is a good thing for the flight attendants, they have more flexibility in what they can wear, but it's not uncommon to find them wearing like polo shirts with like Delta emblazoned on it and like just jeans, not jeans, but like, you know, khaki pants of some kind. And it speaks to the more mundane, like everydayness of flying now. It's not necessarily that special leisure experience it was before. It's become kind of the everyday. Here's another. I think this one I just brought in because it just speaks again to that kind of modularity, the similarity of the environments, that they're not as expressive. They just become this kind of rote thing. This to me also seems kind of sentimental that we wouldn't do today. What are these people doing? Yeah, they're getting delayed. They're talking. Yeah, they're not on their cell phone, right? They're talking, they're hanging out, they're kind of meeting new people, their stuff is kind of, you know, pell-mell arranged around. This still happens, as we found out with our questionnaire. You still kind of do meet more people, but more apt than not, you're plugged into some kind of device, and the whole point of being in the airport now is not to inflict yourself on other people, actually. And we're annoyed when people do that. You know, I mean, I've definitely been in a situation where, like, the chatty person in the seat next to me wants to talk, and I'm like, I actually don't want to talk, I just want to be in my little zone, right? And you use technologies to transport yourself to a non-place of the movie or the email or whatever else it is, even while you're waiting it out. Headphones do the exact same thing. So you create, like, another environment within the other environment, and this predates that, so there's still something kind of, like, nostalgic, I think, about it. Welcome to California, Jane. Again, the idea that you would use the airport for these kind of like reunions and the handmade signs that's not also regularized. On the right-hand side, maybe some of us still yearn for these days, the woman smoking a cigarette in the airport. I don't know if you can see, there's a reflection of one of the new jumbo jets like in the glass there. So she's actually kind of looking out at it. But point being, the airport used to be a place of more human interactions that I think are kind of getting lost in current day airport design. So my last sort of set of slides here brings it up to date with how we actually probably experience airport design. I brought in this just traffic, you know, congestion at the airport. They have rush hour at the airport. They have their own. I mean, we all know you get in line to wait to take off. It's the same thing, just waiting at a traffic light or something like this. But I wanted to point out the sheer number and scale and different sizes and types of planes, because most of the literature I found when I was researching this was kind of written, a lot of it was written actually right before 9/11. I think that like 2000 or 1998, and I think that 9/11 has really changed actually airports quite a bit in a way that historians have not yet addressed, so that we can talk about that. And one of the way, and just the fact that people fly so much more than they used to for work, and gas prices are so high. And so you actually have a lot more airlines using small regional jets to do, I mean, you even go to Chicago on like regional jets all the time. I think I fly regional jets more often than I fly jumbo jets now. They're smaller, they're more uncomfortable, they're not usually updated, they don't have Wi-Fi. I mean, we have all been on these planes. But it just speaks to how crowded like the skies are with these different technologies. It's not the ideal of flying in the large jets necessarily anymore. It's about efficiencies and economies. Here is just Hong Kong International Airport, but it speaks to the new design of airports. How is this airport laid out? Like a battleship. That's a good armed for battle. When you go to the airport, you yourself might feel like you're armed for battle, right? You've got everything. I'm like ready. I'm going through the crowd. Security. You know, people are always worried about that. What else?
Looks like they have enough space for
Yeah, they have enough space for large planes. This airport is actually built on landfill. It's like a $6 billion project. It's a huge infrastructure project. So there was just water here before. It was entirely built on landfill to give it the space that it needed. Building new modern airports, this is why New York's airports are what they are, because we don't have space enough to expand to build these new modern airports. And moreover, you start noticing if you travel a lot internationally that the locations that can handle the biggest jets become the locations on the global travel circuit, because they can handle those big jets. So there is sort of a meta community or like a meta nation of places and types of travelers that go on this conduit in the airs and in certain airports and not others, right? So this technology of the plane, the size of the plane, the type of the airport, it does determine which locales we visit and which ones we don't, which locales are perceived as more important, which ones are more vibrant economic centers. They attract investment when they can land the big planes. You can have the conferences there. You can UPS can ship there, right? They attract all of that. The places who can't afford to build one of these big airports, they kind of fall off the radar screen in terms of that whole in terms of that whole phenomenon, right? So these do structure like how we even experience things at a global scale. Also, where are the terminals? Yeah, probably some of this is subterranean. They probably have a train or some kind of people mover system. They're in the main building, right? So you just, I mean, this building actually almost seems like it's shaped like the wings of the airplane to me. Like, this is such a great picture because this Y shape, right? But it's one big Y shape. It goes here, and there's another one here, and the planes just pull up. So it's one massive building. You don't have the separate towns of the terminals the way you did at JFK that you have to traverse, like, a road the way you would drive in a suburb or something like this, like a perimeter road that you get off the highway. Here, it's all contained in one building. So this is a new way of doing airport designs. And when you're in these airports, the architecture starts more looking like this. How would you describe this space?
More space age than
more space age than Saarinen, you think?
No, less than him, but more than what happened in the 70s.
Okay, than the window grand pictures that we looked at. Okay, so more space agey, more contemporary. It's like newer materials.
Shopping mall.
I have that in here. airports nowadays have appropriated the shopping mall type. The emphasis is less on the main terminal, like the way we saw at TWA with a grand terminal that you go into. The emphasis is now on the linkages between the gates. And these are usually where the restaurants and the mall and the sky clubs and this kind of thing are located. So when you first check in, you're in a space, this is just the ticketing check-in counter. They're just these huge open warehouse expanses. They're only delineated by the names of the airlines. There's no really space. It's a placeless kind of space. It's not until you get back behind security that you actually have stuff. And the mall is certainly a paradigm that's been widely copied because the airport can make money. So you always see the... And increasingly, the shops are getting to be pretty nice, actually. If you go to the JetBlue terminal, you can actually get like really nice sushi at JetBlue now. Or Heathrow. You can also... I had a great sushi at Heathrow Airport when I was stranded there once for 5 hours. You can go to like a Chanel store in some of these places. So they're increasingly getting high-end and kind of luxurious. Why do airports need to incorporate these kinds of amenities today, and they didn't necessarily in the 60s?
Well, you know, at Heathrow now, you have to walk through duty free to get to the
very smart.
Yeah.
The comment is so that now at Heathrow, you have to walk through the duty free shopping mall to get to security, i.e., everyone has to walk through it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might buy something along the way. It's the same way when you go to, like, a department store. The escalator is always on the other side from where you are, right? They always are going opposite. That's intentional by the designers because the idea, the more you have to be in that space trying to find your way out, the more apt you are to stop and buy something. So it's totally planned, as are the mirrors, you know, to confuse you and that kind of thing. So they're definitely appropriating a shopping mall typology. So it's becoming more like a city. These are interior streets. There's restaurants. There's the McDonald's. There's the fancy sushi place. There's a Muji store inside the JetBlue one where you can buy, like, fancy design, you know, kind of objects. We've got just the regular kind of shopping mall here. Here's a bar that people are kind of hanging out in. So do you think that cities, there's hotels attached to it, right? Do you think that airports are cities, though? This is my last kind of... In a sense, yes. And why so?
Because they have all the amenities that one needs for living.
They do have all the amenities that one needs for living, kind of.
They know people.
Yeah. They don't have culture, is one comment. I was going to say. That's true. So the comments we can all hear, it's a transitory population, so it can't truly be a city because people are always kind of coming and going. You don't have a true, they're temporary communities that spring up. So we might have all had the experience of the luggage is lost and a group of five of you are all like, usually you're linked together in a community bonded by like outrage at the, you know, at the actual airline. But you do have a momentary community, right? But you're right, and so are you, that sometimes airports are trying to introduce cultures. There might be exhibits there or like a fancy architectural installation or something. So they're trying to make them more acculturated. Or the fact that you can get nice sushi and buy a Muji notebook at JetBlue is an attempt to sort of be more cultured, right? What were you going to say?
Purpose of an airport is for transport, mm-hmm. but like purpose of a city is for, I guess, enjoyment or for living.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like comparing a hotel to a home.
Yeah, Yeah, that's a good point. That's kind of like comparing a hotel to a home, that the function of an airport is to facilitate travel or transport of people and goods. Cargo is a huge thing, too, not just people. But the point of a city is more to live in the city, right, that you're there constantly. So space-time in the airport is much more compressed, right? I mean, you're not meant to stay there. It's a transitory space, whereas the city, in theory, we like to think of it as a more static place that you live in every day, and the realities of the banalities of everyday life is what make it everyday life. You're kind of transcend those banalities when you're at the airport, right? Even as you engage in these quasi-urban functions, like shopping and, like, meeting new people and, you know, whatever else. So it's not quite the same as the city. I'm actually titling it the analogous city, meaning it's an analogy of a city, like kind of a cleaned up space age, like, you know, efficient city that kind of has the tropings of the city, but it doesn't have that kind of like everyday live type of experience. And you also have to think about the populations that are in this analogous city. So it is transitory, but what else?
It's limited to time.
Limited to time. So you might only have an hour, right? Unless you get stuck, you might be there all night or something, but you're there for a limited amount of time. It's transitory. And who is in the airport? Who's in a city that you might not find in an airport? Your friends are not necessarily there unless they're going on a trip with you.
Maybe customs, you don't do this additional check when you just live in the city.
That's true. You don't have the whole customs security immigration kind of check when you're just living in the city, right? So you've got this additional layer of securitization.
It's also a certain class of people who have the money to fly.
Yeah, it's the people who can afford to fly, too, right? So, and that's gotten cheaper as the airlines were deregulated and this kind of thing, so more and more of us can fly, which is partly why we fly so much for work and that kind of thing. But, you know, it is, and within that, there's status of people who fly all the time, like the road warriors, and people who just fly once a year, and we curse them when they have metal in their pockets when they go through, right? I mean, that it's also, like, hierarchized according to social status that way, right?
There is one difference that in the city when you live, not necessarily, but you own the property. When you're at the airport, you're just temporarily there. You don't own anything there.
Yeah, that's a good point. In the airport, you're always a visitor in a sense. You don't own the property. You don't actually have a home there, this kind of thing. Although, interestingly, one of the bigger problems with airports today, there's been a huge uptick in the number of like homeless people that are living in airports. Actually, it's like a big problem in San Francisco, apparently. They are finding people that live there. In Denver, they had to have a big crackdown because they were bringing in their own potted plants and like decorating their own corners in the airport. So they were appropriating this transitory, ephemeral, non-place as a place. So people do want to make it into a place. So it kind of speaks to the role that the airport has taken in our society, that it's an analogous city, but we're kind of still trying to make it one at the same time. Prostitution does happen in airports, actually more common than you would think. You know, if you're a male traveling alone, you're most apt to be, you know, in this circumstance if you get hit on by a prostitute. But women will come up and say, hey, you want to, how are you doing? They'll sit down and have a drink, but they're actually there to solicit business, and they use the parking garages. So people are starting to use it as kind of an urban space, even though it's not. I think one issue with like which publics are in there is that despite these sort of random attempts, and usually a security force wants to get these people out of the airport right away, it's not a truly public space. This is my last slide here. It's called In Place of the Public Airport Series. We're looking at the inside of an airplane. I'm sure we know this drill by heart, most of us. We fly so frequently. It's the flight attendant going over the safety instructions on this generic airplane. We immediately recognize where we are because the interior design of airplanes is all calibrated again and perfectly designed to instill a certain emotional reaction in the people in the plane. So you don't feel claustrophobic. You can handle being in there for a certain amount of time. So that lighting that you see, the slope of the roof, that's all calibrated to induce a certain kind of hopeful emotional status of calming, not claustrophobic, you know, kind of experience. But this isn't truly a public space, right? The airport's not truly a public space because you don't have the everyday realities. You don't necessarily, as much as possible, have the homeless people. You don't have actual real life happening there. You have like a simulacra of life happening there.
There's a big difference between I'm not sure of what the phrase is, but airside and the other side. Yeah,
of airside and the other side. What
yeah
do you mean?
Well, when you know, a lot of people are panicking because then they haven't got through customs and
yes
things like that, and you're saying that, you know, you're more likely to be tapped up by a prostitute for your phrase on that side rather than air side. So there's a big difference between the two.
Right, that's a good point. When you enter through those security gates, that could be like the transitional, the gateway. The new gateway is the security gate and the you know, metal detector and whatever else. And there is a lot of anxiety and fear associated with getting through that security checkpoint, also just flying in general. A lot of people do, like 25% of Americans report being very afraid of flying. Because you're kind of putting your life in someone else's hands, actually, and that anxiety does add up, especially if there's delays and there's complications and the security, and it creates this kind of environment of fear, you know, that designers try to like mediate and modulate by having shopping and diversions and drinking and, you know, the airport lounge and like whatever else. It's all to mitigate that emotional anxiety that people have. Once you get through some of these stages, like the security, it is different on the other side. Yeah. And your friends can't go with you, as you pointed out. So once you pass through that gateway, you kind of have to do it alone. I mean, there is something sort of frontier-like about, you know, this permanent, you pass through, you're alone, and you're a different person kind of on the other side. And you're left to your fears, or left to your drink, or left to meet the prostitute or something. It is a different kind of state of mind.
You don't get rain and snow inside the
airport. You don't get rain and snow inside the airport. It's true. Although new airports, they are trying to include more outdoor space. It's one of people's biggest gripes about the airport, because when you enter in through those doors, you are in this, like, until you land at your destination, because the airplane is the same thing. And since you no longer get on the runway to get onto the airplane, you're in that jetway, you never see the light. If it's a nice sunny day, you don't feel it. You just look at it as a representation of nature out through the windows, right? So they're actually trying to incorporate some public space that is outdoors in newer airport designs, or retroactively fit to have, like, you know, little park benches and some flowers, just to give people a respite from that hermetically sealed environment. Yeah, it's nice that you don't have to get rained on getting onto the airplane, but if you're stuck in an airport for 12 hours, it can start feeling very inhuman. And I think that the length of time that people are spending in airports is part of the reason for these design changes, like the shopping malls and the bars and trying to include parks and whatnot, because some people literally do work across the globe constantly, these like road warrior travelers. So they are, the record for a Hilton guy, he spent 330 nights in a Hilton. He was like a Hilton, just his expense account was connected to Hilton or whatever else, not at home. So people do live like in a meta lifestyle, like in the airports and the hotels associated with them and whatever else, and that kind of is their home. And so the designs are trying to respond to make it more accommodating to these functions, but it's never quite the same thing as the real city. It's like this analogous, you know, kind of city, in my opinion. Okay, I'll leave it at that because I know we're totally over time. I think I probably got to my key points. Yeah, I think I mostly got to it. Any questions for your next flight that you go on to notice the environment around you or the lack of an environment around you? These are huge infrastructure projects, so it takes a long time for airport design to change, which is why something like a JFK persists in its poor status, because of space and money and time and infrastructure. So it just takes, they're lagging indicators of cultural change, basically, the airports are. So, all right. I will turn you loose. Thank you for talking.